V-I-E.
Did I tell you I have a conversation, I have a telephone call with David Satcher on Thursday?
Oh, no!
I've got a manuscript in progress on how violent it affects the African Americans, and I show about 20 to 25% effect on disease, breast cancer, heart disease, infection disease, bone disease.
Fantastic. And see, if you were going to be here on Wednesday, he's going to be here. Yeah.
I just talked to his assistant. I came to their visit.
Oh, okay.
And I got their cards, and we had a white card, and we traded.
Fantastic. So you'll, oh, that's great. Because he has this little card that he puts out, and I, with, ways to assure good health or something to that effect. And he doesn't have vitamin D on it. Good, good, good. And when he was in Boston, I told him that. I said, where is vitamin D? Yeah. Oh, that's great. Yeah, we'll work on it. Well,
so you'll be seeing him on Wednesday?
I doubt it. I don't think I'll be going to this. I may go to the closing session. I thought it was going to be earlier. Yeah. This is a heavy book.
Mark Sorensen's done a very good job putting it together.
Putting it together. No, I don't know him.
He's for years he ran a vegan spa in St. George, Utah.
Which section are you in? The epic section?
Yeah.
Well, you should have been here yesterday.
I heard it. Why in the event?
Well, listen, we have heavyweights here from the University of California in San Diego, and they shot them down. So I'll be eternally grateful to them. Yeah, so nothing like one epidemiologist. Oh, great, great. That'll be fast. Well, thank you. You are so thoughtful. I appreciate it very much.
So I've got the manuscript in mind for the Jewish National Medical Association.
Okay, so you'll get that. Yeah, and let us know if we can help in any way. So that's where Carol gets her good slide from.
Collaboration,
yeah.
She
I love that slide.
I love this one too. I give her a credit for this. I said we need a slide about it all together. Okay, that's done, so we'll just skip back to the beginning.
So why don't we come?
Okay, so
come on up. And you're going to be the first person. And I understand.
Okay. Well, then I'll just go ahead.
I understand that we can't. The mouse doesn't work, so you have to use this keyboard to advance. the keyboard, I guess.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it has been working. So if I go click like this, it goes ahead. And I go like this, it goes back.
Huh.
So at least it goes ahead. Maybe this goes back. Let's see. Yeah, it worked.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
I'm sitting there.
Okay, Susan, Doctor.
You want the palette?
Yeah, we want you to come.
Come on up. Where do you want us to sit?
Okay, let's see. We'll play musical chairs.
Okay.
So you're the first one, so you sit
right
here, and then when the next person comes, you take that person's
seat.
Okay,
good.
Yeah. No, they want you to sit here, face the audience. That's the requirement. Yeah, we can. Dr. B. Let's see. But we'll play musical chairs when it's your turn.
Okay.
Because it turns out. Okay, I'm on first, and then.
Go for it.
Yeah. It rigged it. Good afternoon, and welcome to session 3401, Vitamin D for Optimal Health and Disease Prevention. We very much appreciate you being here at this late hour, so we said the truly committed are in this room at this time. So thank you for coming. I'm Azzy Young, the President and CEO of Mattapan Community Health Center, located in Boston. I want to also acknowledge my colleague, Dr. Douglas Beeble, who is our medical director and the champion for our vitamin D initiative. This session, of course, was organized by the Community Health Planning and Policy Development Section, and it has been endorsed by the Food and Nutrition Section, so we're very pleased about that. You probably know that vitamin D deficiency is a major public health problem. But the good news, is that the treatment is simple, safe, effective, available, and affordable. And we're going to hear all about this from a panel of seasoned experts. And they are from California as well as Canada. So we should have a wonderful discussion today. One change in the agenda, Dr. Susan Whiting will be the presenter for the second presentation. We also will use the process that is common for the Community Health Planning and Policy Development Section, and that is we'll hear all of the presentations, then we will have questions at the end. So we promise to save questions, time for questions. And the purpose of this session is to inform you, to inspire you, and incite you to action. And that is something that we hope you will take from this particular session. Our first presenter today is Dr. Cedric F. Garland, who is a professor of the Department of Family and Preventive Medicine at the University of California in San Diego. He's a member of the Moores Cancer Center at the university. And Dr. Garland was formerly at Johns Hopkins on the East Coast. Not enough sun, so he moved west. and he's going to talk to us about the uses of vitamin D for cancer prevention. Dr. Garland.
Thank you, Azzy. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. The journey I'm going to take you on today started out with a map, much like many journeys in history. This is the map of breast cancer incidence in the United States that was shown to us by Robert Hoover, to Frank Garland and I, by Robert Hoover in 1974 at the Johns Hopkins University, and we were among the first few people to see it. At that time, it was for a slightly earlier period, but it looks about the same. The key feature of it is if you draw a line through what could be called the Mason-Dixon line, you'll see that, and that's sort of the middle waistline of America, that there are not very many areas beneath it that are in red. And as you can see, red is the highest death rate, 29 to 33 per 100,000 population. Blue, it's around 15 or so. So it gets down as low as half in the south compared to the north, with a number of counties in between. And what struck us was the relatively low concentration south of that line, 37 degrees north latitude, about where the 400 is on the east coast. And also the aggregation in the northeast quadrant of the United States, which, as you can see, has low levels of sunlight. The 350 contour defines that area. And those are due to a phenomenon where ozone accumulates in the northeastern quadrant of continents in the northern hemisphere, but also to the accumulation of air pollution, specifically from the burning of high sulfur soft coal that remains aloft in the atmosphere until it's ultimately deposited as acid rain or transported across the Atlantic Ocean. And you'll notice a couple of red areas, our county and Los Angeles. We weren't deterred by those because we believe those have a large migrant population of people who came from the upper right. This map, incidentally, was part of the War on Cancer launched in 1970 by President Richard Nixon. And if you look up at Montana on the left side, you can just barely make out his profile, kind of an indication that he left behind. The sun is the source of ultraviolet B, and we believe it is the reason for those differences in mortality. Only 1% of it or so is actually ultraviolet B, which is what's needed to make vitamin D. It's also the one that's been believed to be responsible for burning, although not the key element in skin cancer. Four ultraviolet B photons combine with one molecule of cholesterol to make pre-vitamin D, and there's no change in the molecular weight. And just gives you an idea of solar irradiance. The blue line is the total amount of energy coming from the sun. And as you can see, most of it is in the visible part of the spectrum or the ultraviolet A, 320 to 399 nanometers. And only a tiny chunk is actually in the ultraviolet B. And this is actually very delicate and very susceptible to aerosols, to ozone, to clouds, and just about anything else that comes along in the optical column between us and the sun. And that produces much of the variation that you see. Well, what we're going to do is see how this relates to vitamin D and cancer risk based on some studies, 15 studies of oral intake of vitamin D, and you can read what the rest are. By now, there are some 60 studies of various kinds, but these are the key ones that contain the data most clearly displayed on the association. And we'll start out with colon cancer, and it was the first area in which the work was done. And this is a study by Tangria et al. In Finland. And what they found was that as the serum 25-hydroxyvitamin D, which is the main form of vitamin D that circulates, goes up, the incidence, or the odds ratio in this case for cancer, of the colon goes down. You can see by the time you get up to about 24, it's less than half as it is when you're down around 8. So a 50% projected reduction. based on generalizing from this observational study, with 23 nanograms per ml, which is near the average for the United States. So half of us are in that high-risk area where a 50% reduction could be achieved if a high enough dose were available. And here are this is called this is a dose response gradient, where we combine all five studies that had quantiles, and this shows you the reduction in incidence with 34 nanograms per ml, about 50% across all five studies that are extant. And we were quite surprised when we plotted this, although it's on a logarithmic vertical axis, it turned out to be quite a straight line. And that's just what we had hoped to see, because it provides promise that it may continue along those lines. Here's a forest plot of all the studies that were used. And oddly enough, the Garland study in 1989 maybe was convincing because it had a dose-response relationship, but not because it was statistically significant. But studies that replicated it in later years eventually were statistically significant. And overall, the pooled odds ratio would, as you might expect, be about half. When you get up to the top quartile of intake of vitamin D in your blood, 25-OHD in your blood, you have only half the risk of colon cancer, which is the second leading cause of cancer death in North America. So what can we learn from the NHANES cohort? Well, this is what we recently learned in a study by Friedman et al., namely that as your vitamin D went up, your risk of colon cancer went down. This is in the serum, and they used nanomoles, and you'll see we use them interchangeably, but they are different. If you get up to 50 to 80 nanomoles, it's about 44% of risk. And if you get up above 80 nanomoles per liter, which is 32 nanograms, it's down to 0.28. So you've gotten rid of nearly three-quarters of colon cancer, if the observational study results can be generalized, by getting people up to 32 nanograms per ml in the NHANES survey. And what about breast cancer? Well, at about the same time, or slightly after, the association with colon cancer was recognized, it was also discovered that a similar association existed for breast cancer. People had previously thought that there was an association between sunlight and lower risk of cancer, but had never linked vitamin D specifically with it, and modern technology allowed us to link serum vitamin D with the risk. And what we found, and this what was found in this study by Lowe et al., was that if we could just get people up to about 48 nanograms per ml, generalizing from this population would suggest we could probably eliminate half of breast cancer, which isn't particularly difficult to do. One of the more recent, this is a nurse's health cohort study, and this is colorectal cancer. We'll just allude to colorectal cancer for a minute here. And this, because it just came out recently, this is by Kimmy Ning and her colleagues at the Sydney Farber Cancer Center. And what they found was that they had a referent that was quite low, 16.5 nanograms per ml. And when they got up to 24 or so, they had a 20% reduction in incidence of colon cancer. When they got to 28.9, it was about the same. And when they got up to 40 nanograms per ml, then they saw that halving of the risk that usually occurs in the range of 30 to 40 nanograms per ml. This is a recent study from Heidelberg, Germany. This is a case control study. And as you can see, the reference is pretty low. People have rather low levels of 25-OHD in Heidelberg, 12 nanograms. Individuals that had, a little higher, 12 to 18, that odds ratio was about two-thirds. And those that were at 18 to 24, their odds ratio was about, 40% less. And finally, by the time we get up to the levels that we have here in the United States, it was at 24 nanograms per ml, which is less than half the incidence of premenopausal breast cancer. And the reason I show you this slide is that some people have wondered whether this effect applies just to premenopausal or just to postmenopausal breast cancer, although 80% of breast cancer is postmenopausal. Well, this slide shows that the effect is present for premenopausal, and let's also look at postmenopausal breast cancer. and we'll step through this quickly. What you see is by the time you get these people up between 12 and 18 nanograms, you're almost to half, and 18 to 24, and you're at half. And for the postmenopausal women, if we can get them up to 24, generalizing from the observational study, it should be a reduction by more than half in postmenopausal breast cancer. So the answer to the question of whether it applies to pre or post is it applies to both. If you take the studies together up to the point of the Abbas et al. Study in Heidelberg that I just showed you, this is what you get: a 52% projected lower risk with 50% projected lower risk with 52 nanograms per ml. It makes it easy to remember because if you know the number of nanograms per ml, you know the reduction in the incidence of breast cancer. So about a 50 nanograms per ml serum level will eliminate half the breast cancer incidence. This was also true in the NHANES cohort, although it wasn't widely heralded. But here we're looking at nanomoles, and this is equivalent to the break at 25 nanograms per ml, which is at the median. And sure enough, it's there. It's about 0.28 for people that are at or above 25. So the story here is that in the NHANES cohort, which is about as good a cohort as we're going to find in terms of representativeness, you can eliminate nearly three-quarters of breast cancer, generalizing from the observational study, simply by ensuring that the vitamin D level is 25 or more nanograms per ml. But what about ovarian cancer? This has been a perplexing mystery in cancer. And it turns out that the pattern is approximately the same. And when you get up to, about 30 nanograms per ml, you've got about half of it less. And this is in the nurse's health cohort. And there are also some studies of oral intake that are similar, perhaps not quite as consistent as I've shown you. But serum is the best way to measure vitamin D status. And so for this presentation, I'm showing you the serum results. These usually start as naturalistic studies. And this is a paper by Moore et al. That looked at kidney cancer by latitude. And if there's an association with latitude, the line, which would normally be under the null hypothesis, just a horizontal flat line, becomes this line, a parabola. We call it a smiley. And in fact, if you look at it mathematically, it's the inverse of the cosine of the latitude, which is an indication of the strength of the solar radiation. We often see little variations. Normally, Iceland is in the upper right corner, and New Zealand is somewhere near the upper left. We see the Czech Republic here, probably a result of air pollution, providing condensation nuclei for clouds that block UVB. And countries like Zambia, Swaziland, Yemen, and the like are almost always at the bottom of these curves, suggesting that the high levels that we see of about 15 to 20 in the northern hemisphere could be as low as nearly zero, part of the human condition. So, after some 28 years of observational studies, eventually a randomized controlled trial was performed. It was published in the middle of 2007. That was done by Joan Lappi and her colleagues at Creighton University. And they enrolled 1,000 or so women, about 67 years old. These are all postmenopausal. Most of them finished the trial. They started out at 29 nanograms per ml, and the serum was raised by the intervention to 38, which follows a rule of thumb that for each 1,000 units of vitamin D, you bring the serum up by about 10, and that's a good one to keep in mind. 1,000 units of vitamin D raises serum 25 OHD by about 10 points, and they received calcium as well. And their outcome was all cancers. And this is what they found. They express it in terms of survival, the placebo group and the calcium and vitamin D group. And the placebo group looks like about maybe 8% or so had a recurrence or died, whereas in the calcium and vitamin D group, it was maybe 3%. So this led to a relative risk of 0.40, a reduction to about 40% of the usual level of cancer in these women who took calcium and vitamin D. Now, a reviewer must have said, well, you've got to exclude the cases in the first year, because how could it possibly work this quickly, thinking that the association might disappear? Well, here's what was found when that was done. The placebo group, about 7% died, and which is about what you would expect. In the calcium group, about 4% died or had a recurrence. And in the calcium and vitamin D group, it was only about 1% that died or had a recurrence. And so this relative risk is 0.23, meaning that you only have one chance in five of getting cancer if you're taking the vitamin D and calcium compared to the placebo. And this is statistically significant. So what we found is that it is within our grasp now to prevent at least half of colorectal cancer, at least half of breast cancer, with a modest intervention. And oddly enough, this is a situation where the epidemiology is leading to theory. And the main theories of cancer are these that are described here. But vitamin D has led to a new theory called the devolution theory. And just briefly, we'll jump through it, but normally cells are bound together by tight junctions. This discovery was made by George Pilotti, a Nobel Prize winner who died here in San Diego 2 weeks ago. And he discovered that cells are connected by tight junctions, represented here as red dots, and that those tight junctions cause the cell to, other investigators found that those tight junctions cause the cells to inhibit one another's growth, to prevent mitosis, so that not all cells are stem cells, but the somatic cells generally are bound together by tight junctions. Now, what vitamin D does is cause those junctions to be present. And vitamin D is removed, or calcium is removed, they both are participate in this, then the cells separate slightly, they gain some autonomy, the tight junctions are down-regulated, the glues between them are down-regulated. And then there can be natural selection, phase two. Disregard the red dots for the moment and just look at the cell in the upper left. That's a cell that's faster dividing. That's a new stem cell, according to a formulation by Witcha. And that cell eventually will dominate in level three. It's clonal expansion. So one or more cells which reproduce faster eventually take over the cellular compartment. And we've modeled it, and it takes 9,000 generations for a cell with a 1% growth advantage to take over the tissue compartment. And then what happens is that the most aggressive cells compete for nutrients in the blood supply. They eat up the basement membrane and penetrate it. And on the right, we show all the possible therapeutic actions. The first one is prevention, or to maintain an adequate level of vitamin D. And the range of that is 40 to 60 nanograms per ml. And we would be lucky if one person in this room had that high level of vitamin D. It's very rare to find that. That's probably the 97th percentile. Next step is to allow upregulation of tight junctions and the cadherins, the glues. We can stop that natural selection. Research that's allowed this to be identified recently received the Nobel Prize. Roger Chin of UCSD about 2 weeks ago received the Nobel Prize about the same time that George Pilotti passed on. And he has created dyes that allow identification, like these red dots, of tight junctions. Vitamin D favors the apoptosis because when the cells are in close contact, they reduce each other's growth and keep them on an apoptotic schedule, allow sharing of micronutrients. Well, what happens next? This says you raise it from a mutant seed, you whack it. We've always thought we had to have mutations in order for there to be cancer. They're just almost like hand in glove. But the reality is that it doesn't require that. Even infidelity of reproduction can produce variation that in turn will allow natural selection. So our hunt for the past 150 years for the carcinogen may have been partly in vain. It may not require a carcinogen at all for this process to go forward. But once it does, the cells, if those red dots are not expressed and they are behaving autonomously, compete, invade the stroma. Eventually, they make their way into a lymph vessel. Then a universal phenomenon in biology is colonization. They colonize the lymphatic. Ultimately, they're transported, unfortunately, to the brain, lung, or liver, and then they form colonies there that are ultimately fatal. All of these can be prevented, we believe, at every step, according to data collected so far, by maintaining the expression of these red dots, these tight junctions, that would arrest each of these stages at the stage shown, at the point shown. So it says the first thing you need to do is update your CV. The advantages of the devolution model are that it's based on fundamental laws of life, so we don't need to seek outside the basic principles that were described by Darwin and Wallace, and that microevolution, and it goes on regardless of its eventual consequences, particularly if there's an opportunity for there to be a delay into the post-reproductive period. So no external agent is needed, no carcinogen is needed, although it would be useful if it were present to the evolution, adverse for us. It encompasses all earlier theories of cancer cause. And probably most important for people is that it suggests cancer can be stopped at any point in its natural history, as long as the vitamin D receptor system is working, because that's what vitamin D does. And that we may not to kill cells, we may not need to kill cells to achieve treatment, but instead redifferentiate them and keep them in situ where they won't do damage. This is that rule of thumb I talked about. If you're going to use vitamin D clinically, each 1,000 IU increases serum ID by 10 nanograms, each 100 by 1 nanogram. And the usual level in lifeguards is 60 nanograms per ml here in San Diego. Global impact, so what would it do if we acted on this? This is the number of deaths, cases that we would prevent in North America, 50,000 breast cancer cases, or 26% of the total. And you can see in other parts of the world what the impact would be, the number of cases that would be prevented. And this is an almost immediate phenomenon. It doesn't have a latency period. Well, it says, well, I better go now. I'm almost at the wall. And I am. Is vitamin D safe? This is a graph from Reinhold Weith. And what this shows is that up to 10,000 international units of vitamin D in all the studies that used it didn't have toxicity associated with it. You can see it's rather hard to raise the serum 25-OHD above 100, but that you're not going to see toxicity below 10,000 IU per day. This is in press now at Annals of Epidemiology. So what other things does vitamin D do? Well, it's traditionally known for preventing rickets, which it prevents 99% of if we get up to 20 nanograms. But it has some other effects too. Recent studies indicate that it can prevent 80% of type 1 diabetes of children. And we have a paper on this in Diabetologia. And Elena Hyponen, who first proposed this, proposed it in The Lancet in 2004. And there's a natural experiment supporting this. We know that multiple sclerosis is subject to control with vitamin D. We can get rid of 60%. All fractures, about half with vitamin D. At levels of about 40 nanograms, 50% of falls, and we'll just step through this quickly, about half of colon cancer with 35 nanograms, and two-thirds of breast cancer if we get people up to 60 nanograms. And these are the references, and these are available on the grassrootshealth.com website if you want to review them at your leisure. Also endometrial and ovarian cancer. Renal cancer, we can prevent two-thirds of that. 30% of non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And if all cancers combine, three-quarters with 50 nanograms per ml. So choosing vitamin D status for your patients or members of your family, yourself, the best choice is about 40 to 60 nanograms per ml. Probably the optimum is right at 60 nanograms per ml. To achieve that, you probably will need, or your patient will need, about 4,000 IU of vitamin D, and there should be testing of their vitamin D level and their calcium once that is initiated. So this is the final slide. We propose that adults consume 2,000 to 2,400 IU per day. Adults with medical consultation, 4,000 IU. Children, 2,000, and full-term infants, 1,000 to 2,000, depending on weight.
Thank you very much. Thank you. We'll have our next presenter now, Dr. Susan Whiting, who's a professor and researcher at the University of Saskatchewan in Canada. And since 2002, she's been collaborating with Dr. Mona Calvo on vitamin D with a focus on intake and status. Dr. Whiting frequently speaks to health professionals in Canada and internationally on the need for improving dietary vitamin D. We're pleased that she's here with us today to talk about vitamin D enrichment of the food supply. Dr. Whiting.